Time now for hour number two on our big two-hour weekend get-together here on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Here again is the host of the show, Carol Marks, in conversation with Terry Lenzner. He's an investigative lawyer and founder and chairman of the Investigative Group International, IGI, and he was an assistant chief counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee. He's going to talk to Carol about his new book titled The Investigator, 50 Years of Uncovering the Truth, published by Blue Rider Press.
And really one of the first hostile clients and cases that you got involved in was after Harvard Law School, when you were in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, and you investigated the murder of three civil rights workers in Mississippi. So how did that happen, and why did you write that this was a case that really shaped your future?
Yes. Of course, I had just gotten out of law school, so I wasn't really experienced in any of this. But I had to learn quick, which is also another good lesson. And what I learned was that we were in a different environment completely, where in this particular case, the three civil rights workers, which later turned into the movie Mississippi Burning, I entitled that chapter Murder of the Innocents, because the Ku Klux Klan people who we finally convicted basically followed these civil rights workers who had just arrived in Mississippi, grabbed them, kidnapped them, took them out to a road outside the city of Philadelphia, and in cold blood shot them. They actually competed with each other to see who would be able to be given the right to shoot the boys. So it was a completely different world, a completely different environment, and I had to adjust to that, having not had that kind of experience before I arrived there.
But it also made you want to fight for, you know, the rights of human beings that had been really, and there are lots of different cases where human beings really have had been prosecuted and been acted on and that just weren't right. So I think that was a great experience. And you know, looking back at the way strange things happen to all of us or don't happen that can change our life, in 1973, you were offered the chance to be on the defense team of the man who leaked the classified documents about the Vietnam War, Daniel Ellsberg, and you met with him and you decided not to be involved in his defense. Why did you decide you didn't want to represent him? And looking back, weren't you lucky that that led you to getting hired to be part of that very famous Senate Watergate Commission?
Yes, that's correct. I had just finished, Carol, the defense of the Berrigan brothers and the other priests and nuns who had been indicted by the government for a variety of things. But I was very much taken by both the commitment of the Jesuits which is what Phil Berrigan was, and the other members of that group, because they were totally committed to peace, to obtaining peace peacefully, but also to protect and try to prevent draft board from sending kids over to Vietnam in a war that the Berrigans and the other anti-war people were against. So I learned an awful lot from that. And after the Berrigan trial, I was asked to go meet with Mr. Ellsberg in California to see if I wanted to participate in his defense. And when I arrived there, he was briefing his co-conspirator, who was under indictment, and also had a deal by the government, so he could testify, and the government could compel him to testify. And I told them both, look, you shouldn't be talking about who was involved with this, with the Vietnam War papers, because they could be called as witnesses, and if they don't testify, or if your co-conspirator doesn't testify, then he could be held in contempt because he's got immunity. And I was told to, but I didn't know what I was talking about, and that they were going to do what they wanted to do, and I thought, well, if that's their feelings, and that's what they want to do, that's fine with me, but I don't need to get involved with a group that...
No, they weren't very nice. to put it mildly. And that, of course, led you to your opportunity to be on the Watergate Commission, and you were there almost from the beginning. And what I found so interesting in your memoir is that you addressed one of the most important questions the public never learned the answer to. So why did the burglary in 1972 occur? What do you think the burglars really wanted?
I'm fairly confident in saying that based on our investigation, which was a very substantial investigation, and we came upon a number of things that haven't even been surfaced in the public domain, although they are in our final report, that there were historical events of different individuals being involved with the president's closest friend, Bebe Rebozo, in terms of cash payments of cash that was given to individuals by Howard Hughes, who was a pretty well-known character then and a very wealthy man.
I would say so.
And our theory was that this goes back to two or three different previous elections where loans by Howard Hughes to people who were associated with the government were embarrassing to Nixon and, in fact, caused him to lose at least two elections. So my theory was that we also had found that this had happened again, and therefore, if it ever came out that yet again a third or fourth time where money was going from Howard Hughes through Bebe Rebozo to the president's benefit, that yet again could destroy the president's ambitions for winning this 1972 election.
And you know, it makes an awful, awful lot of common sense. And during the Watergate hearing, something else I found fascinating was that you helped write a subpoena for President Nixon concerning his turning over those infamous tapes of his conversations with others in the Oval Office. And Senator Howard Baker reviewed the subpoena. He was also on the committee you drafted. And he suggested that you change one line. So what was it, and what might have happened if that line hadn't gotten changed? Because I think it's so interesting.
Great question. Really great question. What happened was the committee decided to go ahead and subpoena the president's tapes that had been made over the years. And also I asked for some documents that were related to that and to other issues. The president had been requested to provide voluntarily those materials, and he refused, absolutely refused. So I prepared the subpoena. I went up. We were actually having the hearings at the time. We were right in the middle of the hearings. I went up, and I had Senator Ervin sign the subpoena, and then I went over to see Senator Baker and asked him to sign it, and he quite correctly noticed that the subpoena said you are directed to bring these materials to the Senate Watergate Committee. And he said, Terry, listen, that we can't say that because we can't direct the president to do anything and he can't direct us to do anything. So we're really creating an issue here that is unnecessary. That is to say, the sovereignty of the different parts of the government could create a legal issue that could also be impeding our access to the tapes and to the documents. So that was Senator Baker's suggestion, and he was absolutely correct. Had he not told me that, we could have been confronted with the real problem. I just want to comment also, if it's okay, Carol, that
sure.
That the thing that I took away from the Watergate experience, in addition to the surprises that we in the country had, that the people in the government could have operated the way they did in, as it was exposed in the Watergate investigation. But the positive part of this experience to me was that the Democrats on the committee, senators, and the staff people on the committee, me and the Republican staff people, were very cooperative. It was a very nonpartisan experience. There was no, violent and bitter contests and conflicts. And it's in vivid contrast to, I think, what's going on in the country now.
Oh, it certainly is. And, you know, it makes you shake your head even more. You also went on to participate in another impeachment hearing, and that was President Clinton's lawyers in 1998 asked you to investigate some of the allegations concerning his improper conduct, and you write that independent counsel, who was Ken Starr, he should have really worked on an investigation that was not the president's involvement with assorted women, but his involvement in Whitewater in raising money for his campaign. So why did he go off on the tangent of the women, and was that a big mistake?
To me, another great question, Carol, by the way, but to me, it was a huge mistake. I compare and contrast the Clinton process with the process that we engaged in for the Nixon impeachment process, or the Nixon investigation, I should say, because he resigned before the impeachment took place. But there was total cooperation. If you recall, when it came out that the president had the taping system, and when Alex Butterfield testified, that was actually the question was asked. While we knew about it, the question was asked by the Republican member of the staff, of Senator Baker's staff, and we on the Democratic side decided to let that individual ask the question again and present to the country the fact that he had discovered that this taping system existed. So we wanted to make it clear that this was not a Democratic vendetta to get the president, and there was a Republican involved in it. And ultimately, as you know, Barry Goldwater and other people in the Republican Senate caucus went to the White House to tell the president he had to resign from the office. So that's what I took away from that experience. And the process that was done with the Clinton thing, first of all, impeachment of the President of the United States is the most powerful thing the Congress can do, short of declaring war. If you're going to do something like that, you have to do it very carefully and make sure it's fair and balanced, and that you have evidence that supports your contention to even go in and start a process of impeachment. It's as I say, the most serious thing you can do. This was a frivolous, in my opinion, exercise by Kent Starr and by the people involved in it. They as you pointed out, Carol, they discounted what I thought was the most, if they were going to do something, take a look at the question of whether there was improper activity in the collection of funds, because we did investigations for the Democratic National Committee and for the Legal Defense Fund, and we discovered that there was, in fact, questionable payments of money. And it was all in the public record, and yet they ignored it completely.
That's Terry Lenzner in conversation with the host of our show, Carol Marks, and the book that he has written is called The Investigator, 50 Years of Uncovering the Truth. It's published by Blue Rider Press. I'm Michael Harrison, your anchor, and if you want more information about the archives, the programs, the interviews that you hear on A Touch of Gray, as well as the adventures of Carol Marks, the program's host, check out our website, atouchofgray.com, and we spell gray with an E. Here now is Carol Marks in conversation with Elizabeth Gilbert. She's the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Eat, Pray, Love, published by Penguin. And she's going to talk to Carol now about her first novel in 13 years. It's titled The Signature of All Things, published by Viking Adult.
You must be delighted that critics are calling The Signature for All Things the most ambitious and imaginative work that you've written in your 20-year career. So I got to ask you, why, after such a long time, did you return to writing fiction?
Well, I missed it. You know, I got my start as a fiction writer, and that was all I ever aspired to be. You know, I was a little girl who told people I wanted to be a novelist, which is a very odd thing to hear a child say. But it was truly where my aspirations were. And then in my 30s, as everybody who read Eat, Pray, Love knows, my life kind of fell apart, and I ended up using my writing toward a different purpose, to try to dig myself out of the hole that I was in emotionally. And once I got to a good place, thank goodness, in my life and sort of cleared things up, I found the longing to create imaginary worlds had returned. And I wanted to return in a big way. You know, I wanted to write the kind of big, sweeping novel that I've always loved reading, a big novel of ideas, a multi-generational epic with a strong female lead and a global setting.
And you certainly did all that. And I was very intrigued that there was a book in your parents' library that really was an inspiration for this novel, and it referred to someone who was really way ahead of his time in trying to discover things. So what was the name of the book?
Well, this was a book that was a really rare antique book that belonged to my great-grandfather, who was a Philadelphia lawyer and a book collector. He had purchased it God knows when and from whom, but it was a 1784 volume of Captain Cook's Voyages Around the World, published only a few years after the final one of Cook's voyages returned, without Cook, who had been at that point killed in Hawaii. I had loved this book as a child. We were forbidden to touch it because it was so precious, and it was so big and magical. It looked like something out of a sorcerer's library, you know, as a giant leather-bound antique book. And I loved it so much, in fact, that as a child, I actually wrote my name in it in huge letters on the end pages, thereby completely destroying its value, but at the same time, marking it as my own. And so my parents eventually gave me the book, saying, you know, you ruined it. It's yours.
It's yours.
And once I started to read it again, I discovered that the most interesting character in the story of Cook's voyages to me was not Captain Cook himself, but Sir Joseph Banks, the chief botanist who came aboard in order to bring back thousands of specimens of plants to Europe from all over the world. And that's what got me into this idea of botanical exploration, and that's what led to the novel.
Now, you certainly have a very strong heroine in your book. So let's talk about Alma Whitaker. She's the daughter of a bold and charismatic self-taught botanist. And she herself becomes a self-taught 19th century botanical scientist. And I couldn't believe it, but I guess they didn't even have the word for scientist back then.
They didn't. And one of the things that I really love about the early 19th century is that, you know, when you say self-taught, that applies to everybody. You know, this was the age before professionalism. It was the era of the great amateurs, where people who were autodidacts were making tremendous advances and discoveries in all across the world of science. And another reason that I chose botany for my novel, and especially for my heroine's profession, is that botany was the only science that women were pretty readily welcomed into because of the fact that the you know, plants and flowers had always been considered kind of a feminine realm. And so they sort of snuck into that science through the garden gate and made some really tremendous advances and contributions. So it was really, it felt very plausible to me to have a character who had this sort of towering intellect that Alma has, and to have her be able to make the contributions that she did.
But still, they did discriminate against women because there was something they called botany, and then there was polite botany, and that's what they thought women should do.
Yeah, it's amusing that in the middle of the century there was a movement in the scientific world to, as the president of London College said, to rescue botany from the ladies. almost too many women had come into botany, and men felt that meant that their work was no longer serious. They got pretty insecure about it, and so suddenly there was this shift in language where if you were a man who practiced botany, you were called a botanist, and if you were a woman who did exactly the same thing, you were called a polite botanist, sort of like a lady doctor. and I actually laugh too, because in today's literary world, we almost have the same thing where if you're a man, you write literature, and if you're a woman, you write chick lit. There's still that sort of, you know,
yes,
discrimination a little bit, that if women do it, it must not be serious.
And we need to point that out. What I loved was the way Alma evolved and her passion evolved. And when it came to studying plants, and she eventually settled on mosses because she looked at them with a magnifying glass, and she realized that they were different. Why did she decide they were so worthwhile to research?
Well, mosses are kind of the entire universe in generous miniature, and I needed to find something that my character could study, that she could plausibly break down some of the biggest scientific questions of the day by studying. So I needed to find a plant that was varied and fascinating enough to be able to open up some of the mysteries of science. I also needed to find something that was plentiful and underfoot and underestimated, something that nobody else would have been studying at that time, and something that was in walking distance of her home, and that would have been mosses. And once I sort of had that idea and started looking into the moss world, I discovered that I was absolutely on track. It's the oldest plant on Earth and the most varied. And there was, there's a particular breed of moss called Dicranum that is called the Darwinian finch of the moss world, because it's got so many variations that it would have been easy for Alma to start to question evolution by looking at the moss world in that way.
And so she did come up with the idea of plants evolving at the same time that Darwin and a couple of other people were coming up with it. But didn't she go further and make the point that we're still arguing about today, that the struggle for existence has also shaped both human biology and human destiny? I mean, we're still talking about it.
We are, and one of the central questions that I try to explore in this novel, and that Alma explores, is the mystery of altruism, the mystery of human self-sacrifice, because it doesn't line up with the notions that we have about evolutionary development and survival of the fittest, that we're all on our own and it's a battlefield and you have to do anything you can. You know, there are some theories going on right now. We still haven't solved that, to universal satisfaction. And there are theories circulating about why it might be to our evolutionary advantage to be generous, but sometimes the theories just don't make sense, like why somebody would sacrifice their life for a perfect stranger. You know, that doesn't really help your own gene pool. and there is this sort of mystery of compassion and of generosity, and Alma spends the second half of her life really fascinated by that and unable to come up with a satisfying empirical answer for it.
But it's so interesting, and I loved your book. You talked about so many things we haven't had a chance to talk about that were starting up in North America, particularly in the East, the abolitionist movement. You talk about a very intriguing love story. So our listeners are just going to have to get your book and read it. And I found it simple, yet extraordinary, tender, yet passionate. It was swiftly paced, yet completely understandable. And I can't tell you, I learned so much about the 19th century, and I never realized, how fascinating it was. I still don't know if I wanted to live back then. That I haven't figured out.
I think as a woman, I think any woman who's nostalgic for any time in the past is kidding herself, because it only started to get good for us very recently.
Elizabeth Gilbert in conversation with Carol Marx. Her book is titled The Signature of All Things, published by Viking Adult. We have more A Touch of Gray coming your way right here on this great talk radio station in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. I'm going to be joined the rest of the way in this two-hour get-together by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who just moments from now will be talking with Dr. Robin Chutkan. She's one of the most recognizable gastroenterologists in America today. She teaches at Georgetown University, and she has a book called Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage, published by Avery. Richard, I like that, dumping your digestive baggage. That sounds almost obscene and somewhat disgusting.
Scatological, doesn't it?
Yeah. Or it sounds like one of those late-night infomercials that, try to tell you that this particular, whatever it is, potion that they're selling made of some kind of combination of herbs and grass roots and things is going to clean out hundreds of pounds of unwanted toxic waste that's embedded in your colon and your digestive system, causing you great pain and obvious array of illnesses. And I don't know if those things work or not, but I do know that colitis and gastro problems are very, very real. I have my own issues with them.
Well, what she's talking about is a diet modification, which will help clean you out, so to speak. And, I mean, we all, I guess, have that image, you know, whenever you clean out a sewer pipe, all this disgusting stuff that you get out of it. And I guess your body is somewhat similar to that, where you have your alimentary canal and all that stuff that can lodge within the crevices that you want to get out.
Now, the alimentary canal, I think, is everything from the opening in your head to the opening in your butt. That's the whole darn system. And it all moves forward, you know, nice and orderly through a thing called peristaltic motion of the muscles, which pushes forward. I, from my own experience, and I know you've already done this interview, and it's going to have its world premiere here on this radio station in just a few minutes. You've heard it because you did it. We haven't heard it yet, so we'll listen to it together. But it sounds to me that there are two kinds of gastro problems, one caused by what you eat and how you don't clean it out, and the other caused by inflammation that comes from something other than food. Colitis is not a matter of what you eat. It could be more a matter of how you feel emotionally. And it comes from the cellular level. It's like arthritis of the colon. And often the same kind of steroid drugs are used to put the flare-out down, you know, get rid of the inflammation. That's used for other forms of flare-ups, inflammation. So it can be confusing.
Yeah, and those steroid drugs have their side effects. And it seems that everything you take, you know, this whole unintended consequence, you try to fix one problem and it kind of creates another. And then when you're deciding whether to take a certain drug or not, you weigh which is worse, you know, the side effect or the actual condition that you're trying to treat.
Well, I as somebody who has dealt with ulcerative colitis now for the past 20-some-odd years, can tell you that when you have a flare-up, and it comes, when it comes, people say, well, you're eating spicy food. No, it has nothing to do with what I eat. It has to do sometimes with stress. And then sometimes you don't know what stresses you. Sometimes, you know, you think you have stress, and it's not the same kind of stress that you have subconsciously, that you don't even know you have stress that causes it. But when that flare-up comes, you're darn happy to have a drug known as prednisone. People often mispronounce it pregnisone, but it's prednisone, which is a steroid that is like a sledgehammer to the flare-up. It just puts that flare-up away. Then you have to deal with the side effects of prednisone. But trust me, it's still a wonder drug, because if you didn't have the prednisone, you'd be in worse shape than what you have to deal with the drug. But it's very dangerous, and it's very, very awful to live with. You've heard of prednisone, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. My wife had to take it a few years ago for a condition that she had, yeah. I mean, that's the thing about all these things. Now, there's, you know, this is a little bit off the subject of the alimentary canal, but there's also a study with tamoxifen, which you can take as a preventative measure. Usually you take that after you've had breast cancer, breast surgery. It helps keep it from invading the other breast if it's only in one.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're finding that you can take this prior if you have the BRCA1 or 2 gene malformation, that you can try to take this and it will cut down the possibility that you'll get breast cancer. So that's certainly a positive thing, but it, again, has side effects.
It does have side effects. What, do you know what they are? I mean, is it...
Side effects, well, the positive side effect it has is if you're prone to osteoporosis, your weakening of your bones, it can strengthen your bones, but you have hot flashes, you will probably gain weight, mood swings, all sorts of things like that.
I want to talk a little bit more about prednisone after this conversation, because so many people are touched by that drug. And I've often said it would be something to talk about on this program and never have, so we'll take advantage of the fact that we're dealing with gastroenterological problems. But this looks like it's going to be an interesting conversation with Dr. Robin Chutkan coming up next. Richard Neer, and then he'll be back, and we'll chat a bit as we conclude the program. All this is coming your way on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, which continues in a moment.
You're age 65, and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits.
That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engines.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and now as promised, here's our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, in conversation with Dr. Robin Chutkin. She's one of the most recognizable gastroenterologists working in America today, with a B.S. from Yale and an M.D. from Columbia. She operates and teaches in the gastroenterology department at Georgetown University Hospital. She's going to talk to Richard about her new book titled Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage. It's published by Avery.
You're here to talk about gastrointestinal distress. And first of all, what is it? I mean, is it the typical sometimes you eat too much and you feel bloated? I mean, what are we talking about here and why women especially are affected by this?
So Richard, I am talking primarily about bloating, and I picked bloating because it's something that gets short shrift in the doctor's office so frequently. You know, you sort of get a pat on the head, well, you're just bloated, it's not a big deal. But it can be a big deal. If you're bloated every day, it can be a really big deal. And there are some really important things that you can do about it. And there's some really important reasons that women suffer from bloating so much more frequently than their male counterparts. And the biggest reason is that women actually have a longer colon than men, on average about 10 centimeters longer. And so this leads to a lot more twists and turns. It's a curvier colon, and there are lots more places where the food can get stuck and air and gas can get stuck, and we end up bloated.
Interesting. Now, you say that Western women are more susceptible. I would imagine that's a dietary situation,
that
correct?
That is primarily a dietary situation, as well as a hormonal situation. So there is a phenomenon called estrogen dominance, where we have too much estrogen on board. And this can happen as a result of birth control pills hormone replacement therapy, as well as the estrogen we get exposed to in food, processed soy. There's estrogen in household chemicals, a dry cleaning solution. The solvents in some places have estrogen. So for many of us, we're getting too much estrogen on board, and this can be an important cause of bloating. But diet is absolutely a huge category here. The book has a 10-day plan, and in the 10-day plan, I recommend, it's really not a diet, it's sort of a medical detective plan. I recommend eliminating the 6 foods that are most strongly associated with bloating, and then reintroducing them one at a time after the 10 days to see if you can figure out which one or which ones are causing your bloating. And the 6 foods very luckily spell sad gas. That's soy, artificial sweeteners, and dairy. That's the sad part, and the gas part is gluten, alcohol, and sugar.
Interesting. Now, and it's not necessarily just the foods themselves, but sometimes the way they're prepared, right?
That is absolutely right. So, for example, if you take a food that's not on my hit list to eliminate, but it is on my list of foods to cut down on if they bloat you, and those are beans, legumes. So beans are notorious for producing gas, but if you soak them overnight before cooking them, and you cook them with a sea vegetable called kombu, that can cut down on the gas tremendously. So the way you prepare foods is very important here in terms of whether they're going to produce gas or not.
And the way you chew your food, strangely enough, has an effect.
Yes, there is a condition called aerophagia, which means air swallowing, and it's something that lots of us are doing inadvertently. I'm probably doing some of it today because I have a couple of radio interviews and I'm talking a lot. So if you are talking fast on the phone, if you are not chewing your food properly or gulping a lot of air when you chew, if you're eating and drinking at the same time, sucking on hard candy, chewing gum, smoking, these are all things that can result in air going down into your stomach instead of your lungs, and that can make you go up a pant size or a dress size or two in just a day. People who have lots of allergies here in Washington, D.C., we have lots of people who suffer from seasonal allergies. So they, people end up mouth breathing instead of breathing through their nose because their nose is clogged. And mouth breathers are notorious for swallowing air. So just chewing your food more carefully, slowing it down on the phone, separating the liquids from the solids when you're having a meal, these are all things that can help tremendously with aerophagia and bloating.
Yeah, and really, if this is a chronic thing, you should see the doctor because it could be something else. I mean, even ovarian cancer, bloating is a symptom of that, and there are other things. So in addition to your book and your suggestions, I think it's important, if this is a chronic condition, to seek some medical advice and see if it isn't a symptom of something worse.
I'm so glad you mentioned ovarian cancer. We sometimes refer to that, Richard, as a silent killer, but it turns out that almost 3/4 of women with ovarian cancer had persistent bloating. So it's so essential that if you have something that is not just a nuisance symptom but is really chronic, that you seek medical attention. And I have a chapter in the book called Seriously Bloated where I list the top 10 diagnoses that people need to really be concerned about and the additional signs and symptoms like weight loss and blood in the stool, things like that, that should really make you take this very seriously and seek medical attention right away.
Now, one of the things that has come up in some of the headlines with the 10-day plans and basically flushing the system is that, well, if you're at work, this is a problem. You're going to be running to the bathroom a lot. Tell us about that 10-day plan and how that actually works.
Yeah, so this is really not any sort of a detox program that's going to have you running to the bathroom. In fact, quite the opposite. This is going to have you finding bliss in the bathroom instead of distress. And it really is just, again, about eliminating these foods that can be problematic for bloating, introducing more deeply pigmented fruit and vegetables, those are the sorts of foods that provide us with the phytonutrients, the essential minerals and vitamins that we need, drinking more water, getting more exercise. There are a couple great tips. There's one where you take a 1 or 2 pound dumbbell and you circumnavigate your belly button in a clockwise direction, and that basically just helps to mimic the pathway that the food has to travel through and helps to push the gas out. So there's nothing in this that's really a detox or going to have you running to the bathroom. It's just some common sense advice to help you get rid of your bloating.
That's Dr. Robin Chutkin. And, of course, the interviewer is our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Dr. Chutkin's book is titled Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage. Forgive me for being so dramatic, but I just find that title to be outrageous. It's published by Avery. All right, Richard Neer is going to rejoin us in just a moment. I'm Michael Harrison, and you're listening to A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
For almost every American worker, Social Security is part of the plan for a secure retirement. It's important to know how the program works. If you have questions, the answers are easy to find when you visit www.socialsecurity.gov. Use the retirement estimator to get a benefit estimate. Browse our frequently asked questions. You can even apply for benefits online. Visit www.socialsecurity.gov to figure out your retirement plan. That's www.socialsecurity.gov.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're rejoined by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, as promised. Very good conversation with Dr. Chutkin. Richard was certainly informative, and as I had suspected, it dealt more with the eating and the food and the actual physical clogging of the intestines than what you and I were talking about earlier in our conversation about inflammation caused from colitis and other, you know, offshoots of colitis. And steroid drugs such as prednisone. There are others. There's Asacol, and which is a there's a lot of drugs, and I fear messing up the pronunciation of their generic names.
Well, you know, steroids have gotten a bad name because of baseball, haven't they?
Yes.
You know, you hear steroids, and I brought this up once, and somebody said, well, there's a big difference between anabolic steroids, which are testosterone-based that do things to your body that are somewhat unnatural, and the type of steroids that prednisone is, that group.
Yeah. Well, prednisone almost immediately puts the flare out. And, you know, you can have like 20 milligrams, 30 milligrams, 40, 50. If you're over 60 milligrams on prednisone, you're basically at the top of the dosage. If that doesn't do the job, you got to go in the hospital and they put stuff in you intravenously and they do pulse therapy. And again, I'm not a doctor. I just have experience with myself and other people with this. If you have something like asthma, which is basically colitis of the trachea, I mean it's all the same kind of thing. It's arthritis. It's inflammation, and inflammation they can't really say what causes it. It comes up from the cellular level. Now, people always say to me, "Well, are you eating spicy food?" I go, "No, it has nothing. I could eat spicy food, nothing happens." And you know. Maybe alcohol could hurt it if you already have a flare-up, because alcohol is an irritant. But, no, it comes from mysterious sources deep within you. And we've never fully understood that. Some people think it's stress, but then, as I said earlier, stress can be a problem. But if you take prednisone, you can't just stop taking it. This is the thing that, you know, worries me with elderly people or people that don't are not diligent about their drugs. You know, that's a whole problem if you don't take them properly. If you stop taking, say you're on 40 milligrams of prednisone, 50, 60 milligrams of prednisone, and of course you get all puffy, it retains water, you are hungry, you eat like a pig, you gain 30 pounds in 1 month. If you just stop taking it, you can die. You most likely will die. You have to taper off of it slowly. You're familiar with that, aren't you?
Well, sure. Well, it's like antibiotics where, you know, you have a prescribed level that you have to take over a period of time. And a lot of people, after a week or so, when they're prescribed for 3 weeks, they say, oh, I'm better. The infection's cleared up. The antibiotics have done their work. I don't have to take it anymore. And yet, if you don't, whatever ails you is very likely to come back and then be resistant to the antibiotic because, it's like a flu shot.
Absolutely. And that's a very good, and it's a very different syndrome, but it's another case of don't stop taking the drug just because you no longer have the symptom. And the thing that's so frustrating about taking the prednisone after the flare-up is gone is the longer you take it, you become overweight. You become fat from eating. You become just absolutely, oh my gosh, you're like an animal. You want to eat all the time, and you puff up with water retention, double jeopardy. We're out of time, and good, because it's a very uncomfortable subject, but one that actually, you know, a lot of people relate to. Richard, excellent job as always. We thank you so much for joining us. Richard Neer, senior correspondent. Thank you, Beverly Sandinella, on the front line, our producer. Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program, we thank you. Kevin Casey, Steve Wiseman, the entire Touch of Gray broadcast team. On behalf of us, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next week right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.